This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 67 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Views expressed are not representative of the management of the Kinky Cast. In today's episode, we have Master Ron K. with his views on slavery and many other current issues. Here's your hosts, Woody and Chrissy.
Thanks, Max, and welcome to another edition of the Kinky Cast. Sitting across the desk from me is the lovely Chrissy. She's all pink today. It must be springtime.
It is. Beautiful.
So, who have you brought for us today?
Today, we have a special guest, a dear friend, Master Ron K., as he's known on various forums throughout the internet and at various conferences where he has presented. Master Ron, would you please introduce yourself? You have such a long history, I don't think that I could begin to touch on it.
I'm Master Ron K., been involved in leather lifestyle since probably 1976, 77, somewhere in there. Presented at Lil 10 in Portland. One of the presenters at the original Master Slave Conference in Atlanta. Been judge at multiple leather events in California. Kind of been around a while.
I see that you were named San Jose Master in 1995. Are you originally from that area?
I was born in California. One of the few natives of my age group. Lived in California most of my life until I moved to Tennessee in 1997.
Okay, that's quite a change, the West Coast to Middle America. When you were in California, obviously you became involved in the leather scene there. How did that occur?
I was hitchhiking, and a guy on a bike picked me up. He was kind of interesting. We talked for a while. We ended up in bed and having some fun, and he was obviously a leatherman. He kind of initiated me into the lifestyle, I would say.
That's great. Do you have any recollection of about what year that was?
That was 1975, I guess.
So you've been doing this now pushing 40 years? 35,
yeah.
40 years?
Yeah.
That's great. Amazing.
I was underage at the time, too.
Oh, shh. We won't tell.
Yeah, well, you know.
It's history now. Underage as being under 21 or under 18.
I was 16. First time, so that actually sets it in 1973.
You were an adventurous young soul, weren't you?
Oh, yes.
So, can you describe the leather scene at that time? What was it like?
Very cloistered. You didn't see leather out and about like we do now. If you wanted to be involved with leather or leather folk, you know, you kind of had to go looking for it. Heaviest populations of leather at that time were in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York.
Where were you at that time?
I was in L.A., you had to find it. I just kind of lucked out and that I had my thumb out, and the guy gave me a ride, and we were compatible, and he kind of introduced me slowly into the scene.
The Los Angeles scene was just getting going. We had Guy Baldwin on here a couple weeks ago. He really laid out how the scene had flourished.
Yeah, I've known Guy for 25 or 30 years now, I guess, something along those lines. He's a wonderful friend. Spent a lot of time with him. He actually, my partner broke her back after we moved to Tennessee. She fractured a couple vertebrae. He came out and took care of her for me while I was traveling for business for about almost 2 months.
Wow, that is an amazing friend.
Yeah, that's a true friend, no doubt.
Yeah, his response when I called him on Sunday night and said, I've got a problem. I know that your practice is in suspension right now. You know, you're trying to get stuff together. Would you do me a favor? And he said, what do you need? And I said, be at LAX tomorrow at such and such a time. Get on an airplane. Come take care of my partner for me. He said, okay. He went and got on the airplane and flew out.
I was told that he's not a big fan of air travel.
He is not.
He made this exception for you. That's tremendous.
He and I are friends.
Yes. Master Runt, it occurred to me that Guy Baldwin is sort of the generation of leathermen before you, or is he concurrent with you?
I would almost put him in the generation before me because he's almost 10 years older than I am. You know, we generationally think of things in 10, 15-year, 20-year increments.
That makes my thought process move a little bit further. So he's one generation. You're a good representative of the next generation. What changes have you seen as far as MS dynamics in the relationships through these generations?
I would say, you know, looking at the people that I now know and that have been involved in leather, I know a couple of first-generation leathermen, of what we consider to be first-generation leathermen, which would be people that were born basically before 1935.
I thought they were all myths.
No.
Guy Baldwin laid it out in the show how amazing they were when they came back from the war.
They were some pretty special men. They all, almost to a man, were World War II veterans. Many of them had spent time in prison camps, that kind of thing. And that really informed their commitment to each other and to their groups in some very interesting ways. So, you know, there was that generation, and then essentially the generation after them started entering probably, I would say, late 50s, early 60s. I'm a 1970s kind of vintage. The group between me and them, even though I've got some people that I was involved with that were in the first generation, the generation between us started chafing at the very tribal nature of that first generation. So that second generation started rebelling a little bit. Out of that generation came some of the bigger club, more open kind of things. My generation kind of blew things all to hell. You know, depending on whether you consider an old guard follower or a new guard follower. And then after me, you know, everything kind of just opened up and anybody and everybody got involved. And that's when education went to hell in a handbasket in my mind.
That was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago, but it became so accessible to everyone. We started seeing in culture S&M stuff showing up, that kind of thing. It became almost fashionable to be in leather. I remember in the mid-80s, it was just, we had two things happening. We had this epidemic really taking hold, which scared the hell out of the gay community, but we also had all this material that was being produced and all of these novels and fiction and so forth happening. People were getting involved in it. I mean, Anne Rice published her beauty series back then. That kind of brought the het world into it. And then there were clubs that were established. You know, in California, probably the most notable would be the Threshold Group in Los Angeles. I was a member of Threshold back then. Saw a lot of people coming in and wanting to get involved and do things, but the commitment to excellence and to learning, to responsibility and integrity and all of that was diluted simply by the nature of the environment we were in. It's nobody's fault. It just happened. You know, no matter how you feel about it, it now pretty much the state of affairs in the way the BDSM world is.
You came into it as a gay leatherman.
I was bisexual.
Okay.
Being bisexual back then was a curse, so the men that I was involved with only saw me as being a gay man. My wife at the time saw me as being a het man. She was not involved in any of my leather and BDSM activities. She didn't know about them. You know, it was two separate worlds. I had to keep them separate because I would not have been accepted in either had I not.
It's amazing there's a real firewall between the two types. Women can be bi without any problem at all, but men are often questioned.
Yeah.
Especially back then.
Even now, it's still kind of a little bit of a problem. The people that got to know me and, you know, as moved into the mid-80s and early 90s, people that knew me knew that I was bisexual, but I could walk into a leather bar in Los Angeles. If one of my friends was at the back of the bar, you could hear coming across the bar at the top of his lungs, "You confused faggot." And it's like, okay, you know, thanks. By that point in time, with the people that knew me, it was a joke. It was funny. And I keep reminding them that I'm just taking advantage of 100% of the pool instead of only 50% of the pool.
Greedy. Master Ron, I've known you for quite a few years, and we've had some really interesting conversations. And I know you played a huge role, you and Grandmistress Kay, in organizing the Mass Nashville chapter, basing that upon the Mass principles and mission statement to strive to educate the community as much as possible. And I thank you for that and for what you've contributed to the community. I also read a lot, and one of my favorite people is Raven Caldera, who we have had the pleasure of interviewing a couple of times. And he came to Nashville, and unfortunately you weren't able to attend that weekend of five classes, which were tremendous. He's referenced several of his books, and you are in them as contributing author, and your essays are really powerful. On FetLife, you have a powerful writing, When the Word is Slave, and you reference your thinking along that topic in the Sacred Power, Holy Surrender book. And your essay, I've read it several times, and you title it On Becoming More. I know that we've talked about this in the past. We've cruised through the master-slave forums on FetLife. I know I've followed some of the discussions that you've been involved in, trying to educate.
Yeah.
Kind of getting nowhere. Which is really frustrating. I'd like you to talk about your position on that. What is your definition? How do you view mastery and slavery as relationship dynamic?
Let's start here with a little bit of history. The old guard, the originals, did not use the word slave in their language. They were partners. You know, I had kind of forgotten that along the way because, you know, the culture was changing. The word slave came into the culture a lot in the second generation. By the time third generation came along, it was very common. I got reminded of this pretty strongly when my own internal discussion about what I was doing and why I was doing it and so forth. And when I started talking to Tom Magister, a friend of mine connected us, he and I had some pretty in-depth conversations about the word slave in particular, because that's, I think, the root of all evil as I see it. And he reminded me that the old guard looked at the people they were involved with as their partners. They didn't use the word slave. Yes, they were submissive to the master that they were involved with, but they weren't slaves. I started really kind of parsing the words along the way. I started that before I got into the conversation with Tom, but the second he and I started talking, the thinking crystallized clearly as to what was going on. And what it really comes down to is the word slave carries with it a certain psychological, psycho-emotional set of baggage. And there's absolutely no time in history where slaves were equal, where they had rights, where they were expected to be freely contributing partners to whoever they were in service to. And because of that psycho-emotional conditioning or load that comes with it, my understanding of psycholinguistics, which is NLP, is a very in-depth way of looking at how our language affects our emotions and how we make things work. You know, I started realizing that a lot of the things that I was really upset about seeing people doing grew directly out of the disregard that comes when you use the word slave. It's very easy to discount a human when all you do is see them as a slave. They don't have rights. They're not equal. They don't, you know, have a right to object. They don't have emotions. You know, they're supposed to just be automatons to the master's will. And that, when we start thinking about all of the things that we see as abuse, where it's occurring in the normal person's mind is, I have a right to do this because that person is a slave. That's just so wrong on so many levels. I call the word slave the root of all evil simply because I don't see any defensible position that you can come to or come from where you can divorce slave from the abusive conduct that occurs. If a person wasn't a slave, would you treat them that way? And 99 times out of 100, the answer is no. So I see the people that choose to be in relationship with me as being in a relationship, a real relationship. That means it's a two-way street. I have obligations to them. They have obligations to me. I see the people that are committed to be in service with me as my partner. And that relationship then carries with it a very different set of psycho-emotional loads. You know, because partners are supposed to be helpers. They have rights. They have some equality in the relationship. Even if you've got a senior partner and a junior partner, you still have this mutual commitment to the enterprise that's involved. So I've really tried to, as much as possible, take the word slave out of my language when I'm talking now about our relationships, simply because it more accurately describes the way our relationships can work healthily if I use the word partner.
But so many are going to argue with you. I can hear the storm now of, but I'm a slave. I need to be slavey.
Well, you know, my question is, okay, if you're a slave, then do you readily agree that you have no rights? And if I want to, I can put you down anytime I choose. I mean, you're just property. You're a tool. I can get rid of you when I want. Most humans that are even moderately healthy say, uh-uh. So, no, you're not really a slave. The language has been perverted, and as many ways as we try to get around it, and I've seen just about every way that can be imagined when I've had these conversations with people who rigidly want to stick with the term, it still comes back to the real role that you're taking is a partnership role in the relationship, not a slave role. And on the slave side, it's an attempt to avoid responsibility. And on the master side, it's an attempt to prevent them from having to work as hard as they would to satisfy a partner instead of a slave.
What you're saying is very true, and I do not have an MS relationship with my wife and partner. She is a submissive by nature. I look to give her what she wants as a submissive, but I don't look at it as I could do anything to her, because first off, I love and cherish her, and I want to take care of her, and she takes care of my needs also, but I don't look at it as a slave relationship, nor would I ever. And I also have two other submissives that I treat in the same way. Do I own them? People don't own people, is one thing that is said. But more important than that is when somebody cares for you and loves you, they're around because they want to be around, and you have power exchange with them.
I still get a little bit goofy about the word power exchange, because that's another one of those terms that got coined about the beginning of my generation to make it acceptable for the vanilla folk. When we go and talk, well, we're in a power exchange relationship. It's a very ambiguous and undefining kind of thing. I don't see a whole lot of power exchange occurring in relationships. What I see happening, on the other hand, is use, control, direction, consumption of power going on. Both sides are doing it every step of the way. If it's healthy, it's very active. Both sides are very engaged in it. So power exchange is another one of those words that I wish never had entered the lifestyle, but it's there.
It's certainly a bidirectional path for power. Last night, I had been out all day working, and last night my wife was just touching my back, and the power that was entering me from her was amazing. And it wasn't a submission thing. It wasn't a dominance thing. But it certainly was power flow.
That's an energy flow, and all the activities that I engage in the spectrum, you don't see me using anything artificial very often, because the energy is kind of interrupted when you get to an artificial implement, glass, plastic, whatever. I stick with leather and wood, so forth, simply because there's an energy flow that occurs. Energy is a whole different topic to the relationship dynamic. The level of energy that two people bring to an interaction can be astounding, but both people have to have it, right? When we get into our conversation about the use of terms and titles like slave, it's a very disempowering, energy-sucking kind of thing. If you've got somebody that's really, really strong, you don't want to be taking that energy away from them or doing things that take that energy away from them. You want to be able to enable them to use it and to share it with you. So it's just another element of why I've gotten so put off of the words that we're using and the way we describe things in the lifestyle at this point, which is really funny, because every time I talk to Tom, you know, I'll say, well, people aren't going to like it when I say that, Tom. And he goes, yeah, I know, but it's true.
It is true. I'm living example. I'm looking right now, I've got my FetLife page up, and I'm looking at your page and your writing, When the Word is Slave. The last paragraph there is pretty powerful. Your writing, I'm going to read a little bit. It says, unfortunately, until the leather community actually stops fostering the use of the words master and slave relating to ownership issues, the negative effects that those words carry are going to be fostered as well. We're going to continue to see masters that are abusive of their slaves and who justify it by saying, quote, but they are my slave and they agree to be treated that way, end quote. And we are going to see slaves who internalize the messages they get saying, quote, you are just a slave. You have no right to object to anything your master chooses. He owned you and you agreed to it. There is no cure for the psycho-emotional load that come with these words, and I hope that people start to learn this before they are damaged because of it. And that's a pretty powerful paragraph. That's what you're trying to say in this interview, and I really hope people can listen to that, especially the new people coming in the scene, falling on the ground. I'm a slave. I'm a slave. Where's my master? I need a master. And they have no idea.
I look at things from who brings what tools to the playground. I can only engage to the level of capability of the partner that I'm with at the time. So if I got somebody who's really weak, undefined, isn't clear on what they want, where they're willing to go, what they're willing to do to get it, hasn't harnessed their own internal power, their own ability to self-direct or to focus themselves on goals and objectives, I'm just limited on where I can go. It can be a very dissatisfying interaction very quickly. I don't want to play with children. I want to work with partners who are willing to go there.
Right, I agree. And I know that in our conversations, you don't consider a scene in the dungeon to be a play. It's actually work. And I totally agree with you when you use that terminology into the equation and how things are. Everyone has the right to do whatever they choose, of course.
I tend to agree with you. Humans are pleasure-seeking animals. We're very habitual, and we don't like to work hard. I mean, that's reality, okay? The way I come at things, anybody who's a party to whatever has actually got a full set of their own responsibilities. They're going to have to work at it. It's going to take effort. Understanding what's happening inside oneself is often a challenge. It's not just fun. And most of the people that I see coming into the lifestyle at this point, you know, all they think about is, oh, I just want to have fun. So I see a lot of strong drivers pushing people into the play side because it's just fun. For me, it's not very rewarding because I know the depth of the pool that I can swim in when I have a partner who's done the work, who is willing to work with me to really go there. And it's two completely different environments. Do I understand why people get very resistant when you start trying to change the language into something that requires an active involvement? Yeah.
Yeah, because it requires an active involvement.
But I'm not going to change my opinion. And after this long, I think I've got enough failures in the other way to understand that my opinion, at least in my experience, is pretty valid.
How did you come to be known as Master Ron?
I earned it. Simple as that. I spent time in training. I was given the title Master somewhere around, I'd say, 78, 79, something like that. I demonstrated demonstrable skills at various activities. At that point in time, I had control of myself. I had a pretty good understanding of myself. Back in the mid-90s, I was promoted to senior master in my tribe.
This isn't like the internet now where I just go out and choose the name Master Poobah.
No.
So you actually have to work and earn it.
You have to demonstrate skills. I mean, you talk to Tom Magister, you know, he talks about his training and the practice that he used to engage in with certain techniques. And he didn't become a master until he actually had mastered the techniques involved, and then somebody in his group referred to him as Master. His first partner, his name was Charlie, and he wrote about Charlie in his essay, One Among Many. And that was a very deep relationship. But Charlie didn't call him Master. Charlie called him Tom or Sir. They had a partnership relationship. Now, it was others in the group, when they saw what he was doing and saw that he exhibited a level of mastery, skill and understanding and knowledge, that's when he got the name Master, or the title Master. And that's kind of how I got it. I haven't always lived up to it, unfortunately. I got seduced by the dark side of the whole mid-80s, early 90s debacle in my mind. I bought into the whole master-slave thing like a lot of other people did. Kind of just ignored some of the stuff that I'd been taught. And that set up some pretty crappy dynamics with my relationships with people.
Are you saying that you were full of yourself?
Oh, of course.
That's never happened in the scene that I know of.
Yeah, I thought I knew everything at one point. I didn't, but, and least of all myself. And I certainly hadn't spent, significant time really understanding the various nuances of what I was doing at the level that I'm at now. I mean, I've spent the last 15 years kind of retooling and trying to really understand, okay, how did I screw that up?
I think a certain level of narcissism occurs to anybody who's feeling strong, feeling like they rule, even if it's just their own little kingdom. And it takes a few knocks off the horse before you start to reassess. And I think that probably happened to you somewhere along the line.
Get back on that horse and stay there. Because, in my life, my seminal event was in my relationship with my partner, who is now my wife. She started out as my slave. And to say that I treated her badly the first couple years would be pretty accurate and maybe a bit on the mild side. And if I wanted to keep that relationship, because I was deeply in love with her, there was no question about that, I needed to figure out what the hell was going on. And that required a whole change in my understanding and approach. So I spent the last 15 years really working to be a better partner to her and understanding how my behavior was causing problems in our relationship. A lot of work. But in that process, in digging, trying to find the roots of the various issues and so forth, looking at language, looking at attitude as a result of language, looking at behavior as a result of attitude, that stuff all kind of flowed together. And it wasn't that long that it came to me that the word slave is a really pernicious thing. It was at the root of all evil, for me, anyway. Other people may choose to believe that they have a perfectly good relationship with the word slave and never have a single problem in their entire life.
In your case, the M and the S have completely different meanings. The M is the mastery of your technique and yourself, as opposed to the S part, the slave part, is not related to your mastery.
No, there can't be a relationship. When you see yourself as a master, you have to have mastery. Go back to the samurai culture. If you look at that culture, if you read the Bushido Code, you start seeing very quickly that those men weren't so much focused on being warriors, per se, as in being able to fight, because they could fight. There was no question about that. It had absolutely everything to do with how they themselves behaved within themselves and how did they embody their beliefs. There's one example in a book. The man is working in his garden, and he doesn't have shade, and he had a parasol up to shade himself, so he closed the parasol and put it down because it was a small one just for him. A Westerner asked him why he did that, and the response was, "My parasol could not provide shade for my friend while we were talking, so I chose to close it so that I could be with him." That very deep embodiment of relationship and communication was at the root of that intent. And I think that is really something that we don't spend a whole lot of time talking about in the community at this point. Do we really intend what we do?
I agree. There doesn't seem to be a lot of thought that goes into many things that I witness occurring. Of course, I don't know all the backstories and all the details. What I see is just surface.
Well, the golden rule applies, and I can walk into any space and watch people interacting And if I were to stop somebody and ask them rather directly, would you like to be treated the way you just treated that person? Almost every time the answer is no. And my question then, why are you doing it to them? And the answer is because I can. And that's bullshit. That's wrong. And at some point we have to, within our communications within the community, say that certain things are just wrong. You don't do things to other humans that are destructive, period. I mean, you know, there's no justification for it. None. Zero, zip, nada. Yeah, we should be very accepting of a wide variety of activity, but none of that activity can be abusive or destructive or damaging. It's not okay. That's character. We talk about the old guard. They very much embodied their belief. They were what they believed. They didn't act that way. They were that. It's like the cadet's code of conduct at West Point. It says, we shall not lie, steal, or cheat, nor tolerate those that do. Well, that was the old guard's code of conduct, too.
What do you see in the current leather community, meeting more and more people that are identifying as leather? And I'm liking what I'm seeing, really pulling me toward it more and more. What do you see happening now?
I see some trend towards more principled approaches. I still see too much reliance on bad language, which obviously I believe sets up bad behavior.
True, but don't forget, the folks that are doing this now are 25, 30, 35. Some are older, of course, and have experience with, you know, other generations of folks and different concepts. But most of the people are being influenced by the internet.
Oh, well, I could go on for years about all the BS that's on the internet. We don't even have to go into the community-based forums and all BS that's circulated. When people read things on the internet, they somehow accept that they're true. If somebody published an article that said, the piece of iron that I just took out of the forge that's white hot is cold, somebody out there would actually believe that because it was published on the internet. Most of what's said is not very well thought out. Hardly any of it is based in any fact, has any background in how human psychology, physiology, biochemistry, any of that. And reality is, when we choose to engage in the activities we choose to engage in, we're affecting the biochemistry of the human body and the psychology of our partners. We better understand a little bit about that stuff, or we're going to be messing with a very explosive mix of things. And if you say that in a place like FetLife, you know, you have 1,000 people that rile against you that say, oh, bullshit. And, okay. So, you know, I tend to not engage anymore, simply because I'm tired of arguing. I don't have the heart for it. People that want to learn, they talk to me, I talk to them. Okay. If they learned something, great. If they didn't, cool. At least I got to clarify a little bit of thought for myself.
Right. We offer educational meetings through our Mass Nashville chapter. You know, you were instrumental in forming that. You know, I've been working with them. I've tried to continue that and bring in people that can present thoughtful and interesting perspectives to the things that we do. Master Ron, I'd like to thank you. We're going to be wrapping this podcast up, and I really appreciate you taking the time today to come and share your thoughts and your experiences with us. I hope that we can do it again.
Anytime, any topic, you know me. I've always got an opinion.
Master Ron, it has been wonderful chatting with you today. As Chrissy says, we look forward to hearing from you again. We'll be right back after this word from the Southeast Leather Fest.
No matter how you identify, mistress,
master,
owner,
primal,
daddy,
submissive,
girl,
poly,
slave,
switch,
you belong at self. Visit SELeatherFest.com. Come to South June 11th through the 14th in Atlanta and erect your vision.
On the phone with me from lovely Kansas is Candy. How you doing out there today?
Oh, doing pretty good. Weather's warm. We're good.
All right. Spring is springing in the Great Plains. You have an event coming up. Tell me about it.
What we have coming up is an event we call Kinky Carnival. We came up with the idea of Kinky Carnival 10 years ago, so this is our 10th year. We started in our backyard, and we eventually had to move to a motel. We kept fighting the rain, the hail, and more rain, and the mud, so we decided it was time to take it indoors.
Well, that would make sense.
Yeah, after so much rain, you just, you know, you can't float too much in the backyard anymore.
So tell me about the Kinky Carnival. It's evolved over 10 years. What has it evolved to now?
What we do is we bring presenters in. We've got 8 presenters coming in and 2 local ones. This will be their first time teaching for us on Carnival. They will be teaching on Friday, and our other presenters will be teaching on Saturday. We have 20 classes that they can choose from. We provide a meal at noon on Saturday. It goes with your ticket. We have 2 play party dates. One will be on Friday night, and one is on Saturday night. We also take a lot of people. We'll all get together and just do a Dutch treat, and they'll go out to eat on Fridays. And then the Saturday afternoon meal, they go meet somewhere, and they eat also on a Dutch treat deal. We have several things that we do. We have something called Kinky Cash. Kinky Cash is kind of a unique thing. It's kind of grown from my little heart and baby, that when you buy your ticket, you will get equal amount of Kinky Cash. So you pay $65 on your ticket, you get $65 Kinky Cash. You go to a vendor and you buy something that's worth $100, you get $100 Kinky Cash. You stay at the motel, you go out to eat. Whatever you spend around this area for the carnival, we match that with Kinky Cash. And all year long, I gather up stuff as much as I possibly can, and you can come back into our little Kinky Country store, and you can buy things with your Kinky Cash. It might be a toothbrush and toothpaste, or it might be a little toy. It can be kinky items. Everything that is in there is looked at in a kinky mind that you can use or use as normal.
It's a general store with pervertibles.
Yes.
All right. So tell me where in Kansas this is.
We are in Wichita, Kansas, the biggest city in Kansas. That's where we've been at for 10 years now.
So the Kinky Carnival is in the heart of conservative land.
Sure.
Okay. But we know there's kinky people everywhere. They got to go somewhere.
Oh, yeah. And this is the biggest event in the state of Kansas. We have people that come from all over. We have friends that come from Nebraska. They show up every year. We have ones from Colorado, Oklahoma, Missouri, Mississippi, Arkansas. One year we had somebody from Italy that showed up.
Well, they got the award for long distance.
Yes, they did. We have people that fly in from Texas. Dr. Bob, he's one of our presenters. He'll be coming in from Texas. We have people just everywhere come in. It's really easy, down-to-earth, good-natured. You walk out with more than you ever walk in with.
Can you tell me a little bit about the classes and presenters?
We have Dr. Bob, and he is doing a spiritual scene with wrapping, you know, saran wrap stuff. And he's also doing our fiery clashing class, which is, you know, when you start fighting or you're disagreeing about things and how to solve those kind of things. We have J.T. Paladine. He's coming in. He's doing a BDSM internet protection, how you can protect yourself on the internet. And he's also doing a class with industrial rope with tying and such as that. We have Callista, and I think she's from Kansas City. She's doing one with Florentine. And she has a second class, but I can't remember what that is. We have Malik. Malik comes from Tulsa, Oklahoma. A lot of people probably recognize that name, Master Malik. And he is doing a class with clothespins. He's doing a class called One Size Fits All, and he's doing a very special class for us on Saturday night, and that class is on a cross, a crucifixion.
Wow.
So that's going to be interesting. Yeah, not sure how I'm going to handle that one, but we'll see. We have Master Dennis, who's coming in from Arizona. He is doing a primal play class and a clarification in lighting. I'm not sure what that one is, but I guess we'll have to find out on that. We have Master Robert, who comes in from Denver. He's doing a suspension one, and he is also doing a bondage and wax class for us. We have Master Shadow, and he's from Denver also. He's doing one called The Art of Shut Up. Now, I could never take that class because I don't know how to shut up. Maybe I should take it. He can teach me how to.
Okay.
The protocols class, and he's also doing a class called Living with Children. We have a Kitten. She is doing a self-care class and tops for the bottoms. I think that's all the classes that we've got that I can think of. So, like I said, there are 20 classes.
It sounds like a pretty full agenda.
It is. And then at noon, we have the meal at the restaurant there. It's a catered meal, and we do a barbecued beef with watermelon and cantaloupe and bread and corn and all kinds of things like that. It's a buffet, and they can eat as much as they want, and that is included in the price.
Good old-fashioned home cooking there.
Yeah, good old-fashioned home barbecue.
All right. Tell me when the dates are for this.
The dates are June 12th through June 14th.
Okay, the 12th through the 14th, and that is in Wichita, Kansas. Is there a hosting hotel that you need to make reservations at?
Yes, there is. Once they RSVP, then we'll go ahead and send them that information. It's La Quinta, but it's on the west part of town.
Okay. The website to get more information?
Is kinkycarnivalks.com.
Kinky Carnival with a K, K-S as in Kansas.com.
And everything they need to know is there, any information to get a hold of anybody's there. And we have a lot of fun. We have people that have been with us for 10 years. And in fact, two of our people have been with us for 10 years, and this year they get in free.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so, you know, some of those other people should have been here sooner. But we do. We have people that come every year. We have people that help us out and, you know, do little things that need to get done. So we have a lot of fun, and it's just go, go, go from the day. We walk in the motel on Friday mornings, and we do not leave until Sunday afternoons. And we start at 1 o'clock on Friday. The vendors will be open up on 1 o'clock on Friday. So you want to come early on Thursday. There's people around there setting things up. And so we're there most of the weekend.
You said you have a vendor area, so you have a lot of local vendors?
We have six vendors that are coming in. We have Miss Cindy, who's from Wyoming. This is her fourth or fifth year vending with us. She does medical things. We have Dark Horse Leather. He makes a lot of shoes and such as that. But we have a total of six vendors that come in. Everybody makes good sales, you know, without having to fight everybody else on the vending area and stuff.
How many people are you expecting for this event?
We normally range around 150, and it can be more or less, you know, just depending on what happens and such, give or take.
This sounds like a fun little get-together for drawing all the states around you.
Correct. Now, one thing we'll tell you here is that we do not pay our presenters. We keep our ticket prices low, so we want everybody to come. It's not about the money to us. It's about who's here and how much fun they have. And we keep our prices low so everybody can show up. You know, we do have certain things that we have to pay for. We do a presenter's auction. It's where people will donate stuff, and we have an auction on this stuff. Money is divided between our presenters is how we handle that. And that helps them out a little bit.
And what is the ticket price?
$65.
$65 for a weekend of fun.
Yes.
All right.
And lots of goodies and lots of fun and 2 days of play, free meal. If you stay at the host hotel, you get breakfast there. I mean, how can you beat that? I don't think you can.
Well, for our listeners out there in the Great Plains, there's a fun weekend in June.
There sure is. And if you fly in, there's a van that will come pick you up. We'll make sure you make it there.
Well, Miss Candy, thank you so much. It's been great hearing from you. We'll let our listeners know. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Eddie.
You have been listening to episode 67 of The Kinky Cast. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, Chrissy, and all our kinky crew, I'm Max. See you next week when we have Fet Life's John Bacoo.